This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2. You'll also find us online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Why do we so often fall short in caring for ourselves and others? Could we do better? Well, to the second question, philosopher J.D. Trout says we can do better. In his new book, The Empathy Gap, Building Bridges to the Good Life and the Good Society, he looks at why we fall short, and he explains how we could use the latest findings in the fields of psychology, behavioral economics, and neuroscience to improve human well-being. Early in The Empathy Gap, Trout notes, empathy is central to our humanity, but rather than elevating empathy, public dialogue has marginalized it, giving way to authoritative and sober pronouncements that we can't help everyone. He also says, our economy may be 21st century, but our political psychology is still state of nature. J.D. Trout is a professor of philosophy and an adjunct professor of the Parmley Sensory Sciences Institute at Loyola University in Chicago, and he's our guest in this hour of the program. Listeners, you can join the discussion with a phone call. I look forward to your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Our guest, J.D. Trout, has held fellowships from the National Science Foundation, the Mellon Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Humanities. His previous books include The Theory of Knowledge, The Empathy Gap, Building Bridges to the Good Life and the Good Society, is published by Viking. You'll find our guest, J.D. Trout, online at www.jdtrout.com. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. J.D. Trout, welcome. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. Well, let's start here with a basic question. What is empathy? How does it differ from sympathy? How are they related?
Well, empathy is usually defined as the ability to participate in our common vulnerabilities, the ability to take the perspective of another person. It's most familiar to us when we take the perspective that we imagine they must have when they're suffering. And empathy is typically contrasted with things like sympathy, because sympathy is characterized as a more self-focused emotion, an emotion where you feel another person's suffering, but your focus is on that feeling and not on the orientation toward change.
What we can do about it.
Right. And so empathy is usually reserved for those contexts in which we honor that impulse to change when we experience the suffering of another.
Yeah. How important is empathy to a good life in a good society?
Well, yeah, empathy is important in understanding other people and giving us the motivation to take their perspective. But once we have that feeling and we have that desire to reduce somebody else's suffering, we also have to be clever enough to vault the barriers that might get in the way. And there are all sorts of problem-solving barriers that we might face when we want to improve somebody's condition. Somebody's suffering may be the result of not having enough money. We certainly have the ability to think about ways to get money to them, but the choices that we're faced with oftentimes get in the way of doing that.
Yeah. It seems that there are a good number of reasons why we're not more empathic. There's the question of where do we start, for example, and we also know how difficult it can be to think and plan for the future.
Right. And that's where the empathy gap is so important. The empathy gap is the distance that exists between ourselves and others. And that gap can be produced by differences in culture, in religion, in personality. There can even be an empathy gap between our current self and our future self. So we can have an empathy gap with respect to ourselves when we plan for the future. It's very common for people to undersave, for example, for their future. And part of the reason for that is that they're unable to properly value the amount that, say, that bear claw that you're hungry for now might be if we were to take that money and put it in an aggressive mutual fund so that in 30 years from now we'll be able to have a surf and turf as we drive across Arizona.
Mm. But that bear claw does look awfully good.
Right. It's just too tempting. And, you know, so, you know, in the same way that evolution had designed us to feel empathy in group settings, it also made us smart enough to vault the barriers that I mentioned before. It made us smart enough to create solutions that bind ourselves, like automatic savings plans.
Mm. You note that a good and empathic society can tolerate common and moderate inequalities. Where are we at the moment? How big is the empathy gap?
Well, you know, when you suggest that the government subsidize individuals who chronically suffer because they're beneath the poverty level, it's important to also make the case that there is some distribution that's deserved as well. That is, some people may make less money, and they may genuinely make less money because they've chosen to try less hard. And so, you know, I made certain kinds of decisions in my life to not pursue career choices that would have paid a lot more. And if things hadn't turned out well for me, I don't know that my claim would be a very strong one. But at the moment, there are situations that millions of people are in, you know, about 12 million children beneath the poverty level, 50 million people without health coverage, and many of those individuals are in that position not because they made a choice, but because all of the options that they had were lousy ones.
You list countries that have made alleviating or eliminating poverty a priority: Austria, Denmark, Finland, France, to name a few. And you note that together, Denmark, the Netherlands, Norway, and Sweden provide about five times more of their gross national income in foreign aid than the U.S. does. What has allowed these countries to make the choices that they've made, and how have they approached the problem?
Yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, it goes right to one of the frailties of humans. They tend to underestimate their ability to adapt to situations. So if you were to propose increased taxes, say, in the United States, so that you could fund foreign causes more fully, there you could expect a reaction from U.S. citizens. And part of that reaction, a negative reaction, and part of that reaction comes from the idea that they wouldn't get used to that money, or they felt like they had to give up that money. What the European countries have done, by contrast, is they make it part of taxation, and the citizens adapt to that level of funding. Now, one reason that people might go along with such a proposal is that Europe has a longer history of involvement in many of the countries that the funding goes to, and they also tend to identify in attitude surveys a cause of poverty as being situation rather than character. So when they see impoverished people in many of the European capitalist democracies, they see someone who is impoverished because of a situation that they were in, because of perhaps bad luck. Whereas in the United States, when they see that, they see the result of bad choices or poor character.
Yeah, our love of liberty and the value we place on the idea of being in control, that, you say, plays a role in the empathy gap here.
It does. And the role is a complicated one, because on the one hand, people in the United States clearly do show great concern for liberty, so much so that people who could never hoped to benefit from, say, reduced estate taxes, still defend the previous administration's efforts to eliminate estate taxes. They could never hope to benefit from that because they would never reach that level in estate size. And they did it on the grounds of valuing liberty. But there are many ways to enhance liberty, and one of them is to make sure that we'll be in a position to make wise choices years from now. So by in the same way that you can bind yourself to an automatic savings plan, you don't have that money to spend now, but later on in your life, you'll have many more choices available to you. That's one way of honoring liberty. Another thing that many Americans overlook is that when they do express that they value the experience of liberty, they don't necessarily recognize that their choices are stunted all the time. They don't notice, for example, that they comply with FDA regulations without thought. They comply with SEC regulations without thought. The government restricts their freedoms, if you want to use that vocabulary, all the time without their noticing it. But also lots of their choices occur habitually. And it's not the result of elaborate deliberation. There was a recent experiment that was done in Arizona on polling for subsidies for public education at a number of different polling sites. And when the polling site was at a public school, the allocations were more generous to public schools. In the non-public school polling sites for that very same agenda, that people didn't give as much. They were unconsciously influenced by the presence of the polling place or the nature of the polling place. And that happens all the time in our choices. So what we really are expressing is that we like the feeling of freedom. That feeling may be counterfeit oftentimes, and we oftentimes don't know that.
You mentioned the matter of maybe going to vote in a school building on a school referendum. You also talk in the book, I found this very fascinating, that that it plays out even in a broader sense in politics when we choose candidates, when we decide I'm going to vote for this individual. There is evidence that that choice that we're making, that behavior, is not very reflective at all, that it is intuitive.
Right. And this is a result of a lot of psychological research that's going on right now that does work on automatic judgment. Right. So we read off of individuals' faces, characteristics of sincerity and so on. We make fast automatic judgments so that we can move on and carry on with our lives. And that fast processing allows us only to pick up one or two cues before we move on. We may have the feeling that we generated this vote on the basis of elaborate deliberation, but once peeled away, it's pretty clear that we only paid attention to one or two cues, and those cues are typically not even diagnostic of the features that we might care about.
This fast processing, does it service or does it do us disservice?
Well, that's a very complicated question because in some contexts it does serve us, and in others it doesn't. So, for example, there's some work done by a Dutch psychologist named Op Dijksterhuis, who finds that if you divide people's attention on important when they're trying to make an important life decision, like the purchase of a car or something like that, the attention that they allocate to the task happens to just pick up on the cues that are going to be important to our long-term satisfaction with the purchase. So the people who have their attention divided when they're trying to make this decision make more satisfying decisions than somebody who's able to devote their full attention to it. And that's an interesting kind of phenomenon. If you have the ability to focus entirely on that choice, you may pick up on a lot of properties that aren't really very diagnostic of what you're going to be happy with. You just happen to attend to them. Right? So if you're looking at a house or an apartment or something like that, you might not quite like the light in the room or something like that. You really focus on that. But that may turn out to be not nearly as important as the fact that the house is larger, or it's got a fourth bedroom, or it's closer to your place of work or something like that.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, philosopher J.D. Trout, author of The Empathy Gap, Building Bridges to the Good Life and the Good Society. You're tuned to The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions and comments. I look forward to your phone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455, 333-WILL. Toll free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, we need to move on in our lives. We need to keep going. We've got a lot of things to do. So when it comes to making an important decision, when it comes to paying attention, how can we catch ourselves and say, wait a minute, what am I doing? What kind of biases might be at work here? Am I going to make the best decision?
Well, those are very difficult tasks, and in a way, they seem like they shouldn't be because they're very familiar to us.
Yeah.
But when you look at the research on cognitive biases, and some of it the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign's famous for, they find that individual strategies are not especially effective in correcting biases. So, for example, when you try to plan, say you're leaving your apartment and you have to move, people tend to underestimate how long it's going to take to move. And so that's why we all find ourselves up at 4 or 5 in the morning,
yeah,
you know, doing the last bit of boxing things up. And that's because we typically take what's called an inside perspective on the problem. We think about what's special about our circumstances now that will allow us to move really quickly through the moving task. Now, that kind of bias is a charming feature of humans. It reflects a kind of optimism.
Mm-hmm.
And that certainly shouldn't be undervalued. But if you want to make an accurate assessment of how long it would take, what you ought to do is actually go with the statistics. That is, think in the past about how many times you've moved and think about how often you moved later than you expected, and use that as a guide, more or less demographic information about your past performance, rather than treating this situation as unique. That's what goes wrong when you use an individual strategy. So think about a concrete case. And I should mention that in a lot of these sorts of biases, they can't be corrected by asking the individual to concentrate harder on the problem. That just focuses them more on the same mistaken strategy that they deployed in the first place. You can't correct that problem by what are called accountability manipulations, by telling them that they're going to be asked to explain why they decided what they decided. You typically can't get them to improve their performance by giving them monetary incentives. So there are very few things that actually help individuals overcome biases, except for certain kinds of self-binding strategies, like having money taken out of your paycheck in advance of your receiving your paycheck, and have that go toward retirement. That tends to work because people don't experience the pain of removing the money themselves, and then they adapt to their new lower level of income without really noticing that much.
Hmm.
The best strategies for correcting individual biases have to do with placing outside constraints on people's settings. And if they more or less accept those outside constraints, then there's no apparent truncating of their liberty or stunting of their liberty. In a kind of well-known situation near to our hearts is the problem of pharmacy errors in prescription. Now, oftentimes when pharmacists repeat prescriptions, they misrepeat them because so many of the drugs sound alike. They begin with the same sound. Now, you can't get a pharmacist to not do that by telling them to pay more attention. They're already trained to pay attention. They're already trained to be careful. And the only strategies that seem to work are what I call in the book outside strategies. They're strategies that change the environment so that if there is a mistake made, it's either caught or regulated. Right? In that case, what you do is you don't permit certain drug names to be used in crowded language spaces. So if there are drugs called Procrit and Procardia, you don't allow many PRO combinations because that invites confusion. And there are now two drug naming councils that make use of psycholinguistic databases to control the names that can be used. Drug companies really liked names that began with a Z sound because they found it sciency in focus groups. And so the psychological space for Z initial drug names was very crowded, and so it tempted errors. And in the case I mentioned, in between Procrit and Procardia, you know, you're talking about very, very different diagnoses if the person took the wrong drug. You know, an untreated heart problem, for example, would be the result. And, you know, the NIH had estimated that roughly 600 people die per year from phonological errors. The number could be far higher than that, given that the problems there are underreported. So many decision problems are like that one, that we face individual decisions all the time, and in order to improve our decisions or correct biases that we're prone to, the very best strategies are strategies that move from the outside in. We improve the outcomes of our decisions by elevating the quality of our choices so that if we make a bad choice, the outcome is a disaster.
There's so much here. Elevating choices is a great thing. We should talk about that. But let's also talk about now here moving from individual decisions to our power together collectively to make decisions. Talk about that, how we could do that better.
Well, the book closes with the discussion of a certain kind of, sometimes referred to as citizen panel, sometimes very colloquially referred to as a focus group. But you can think of them as a mini public, collections of individuals whose charge it is to discuss what things they really value on some topic. And this effort is designed to get at the sorts of things that people really value in their lives rather than simply talking about the hot-button issues of the day. So there are very, very polarizing issues on the United States political scene, and for the last 40 years they have been very polarizing, issues like abortion. And if you want to open up a dispute between otherwise well-meaning people, that's one way to do it. Now, it may the issue that people are divided by may not affect a huge number of people beyond those under consideration. So gay marriage would be another example. But if you can get people to agree about more basic issues, like we would want those situations to be situations that didn't confront people in the first place in the case of abortion, then you might be able to motivate agreement. So these sorts of groups could be used to tap into, if they're properly stratified samples, they can tap into what Americans genuinely believe about things like the legitimacy of foreign aid, and what its importance is, whether and how important it is that there not be children beneath the poverty level in the United States, how much they would be willing to sacrifice to improve the lot of those children or improve the world standing of the United States, given that it ranks so poorly in the rate of child poverty in the developed world.
Why do we turn so often to charity rather than taxation? Why do we have such a problem with saying, you know, this is a problem that needs to be solved? And we, of course, but you know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are a couple of reasons I think that stand out. One is that because of the history of the United States, that, you know, one of the first official acts of the United States resulted from a long war with its originating country.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't have a good relationship with governments in the first place. Halfway during the time of its life, halfway through then, one half of the United States was in war against the its own government in the Civil War. So, you know, that could sour the relationship culturally toward government and make people see the government as an imposition rather than playing a rich coordinating function in people's lives. And because people have that reaction to the government in higher rates in the U.S. than in other countries, we turn to charities rather than turn to government when we look for solutions to problems. And the outlook of the book is that, of my book, is that good causes don't need to compete, and so charities are fine, but we shouldn't leave the crucial interests of citizens to the tender mercies of charity. That is, in times like the current ones, it may be that people don't have enough money to give to charity, and they're looking more at other targets for their money. And what happens then to the people who would have been the normal targets of that money? If there were government programs to sustain those individuals, then the pressures on charities wouldn't be so great when hard economic times hit.
Do you think that the middle class, the insecurity that the middle class is feeling these days, could lead us to pole vault to some extent over the empathy gap?
I think it might. I mean, I think for some time the middle class has been feeling beleaguered, even before the economic events in the past year. There were so many difficulties with credit that, you know, the middle class had difficulties with paying for college for their kids, for example. And so they were already thinking in terms of downsizing the dreams of their children. And so I think the middle class already felt pinched. And certainly it opens up a new population, sadly, to be disgruntled enough to actually look to the government as a potential solution to social problems that individual empathy might not be able to solve on its own.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, J.D. Trout, he's a philosopher. He is at Loyola University in Chicago. He's the author of the book, The Empathy Gap, Building Bridges to the Good Life and the Good Society. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a phone call. Questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now. Listener in Chicago, line four. Hi.
Thank you. I'm reminded from your conversation of the admonitions of the golden rule of not doing harm to others that you would not have done to yourself, as well as other things on that matter. Would you care to comment on that prescription that we've had from the past about consideration? Then you have Marie Antoinette saying, give them crumbs, you know, or cake, whatever.
Right, right.
And other things like that. Well, we see the suffering and misery, and then we have other people who become, shall we say, dedicated to helping solve the, or at least handle the situations like recently we had Mother Sister Teresa and other people through the years, the different saints and so forth, that have you know, been so dedicated towards helping those that are in need. Thank you.
Okay.
Sure. You know, there is a kind of famous maxim in philosophy that Kant offended and was just a formalization of the golden rule of do unto others. And that is a rule that's hard to go wrong by if you follow it. You know, you can always dream up situations in which it doesn't apply well, but in general, it's reliable enough that I think people sort of teach their children that as a handy rule of thumb. At the same time, when you personalize it in any way and you ask, well, I don't want to treat anybody else badly in a way that I wouldn't want to be treated, but certainly if I were in their situation, this is what I would do. Or if I made a bunch of bad choices, I would certainly be willing to pay the price, right? Mm-hmm. The a poor application of that rule or a mangled one can lead people to suppose that they would have performed much better than someone else or that they would have been willing to take the punishment of a series of bad choices. Well, we don't really know that that's true. You know, people who are taking that perspective are at leisure to do that precisely because they're not in that person's position, that they didn't make a series of bad choices, and they can't run a control where they have a version of them who made those bad choices to see how they would react. The best we can do under these circumstances is to try to make sure that the people who face oftentimes just a litany of bad choices will somehow be able to land on their feet. So take, for example, and this opens my book, the example of payday lenders, that it turns out that payday loan storefronts have the highest density in and around military bases in the United States. This wasn't known until about 2005. The rules that loosened the annualized percentage rates on payday loans were put in force around 2002. And nobody supposes that military people are undisciplined, and that's why they took out the payday loans. They have, once again, that admirable characteristic of optimism, and they want to do a little bit better for their families, and they are a captive audience in these camps, and they have a fixed income, and they are really not in a position to make an assessment in advance in the way that, say, somebody who's trained in the creation of arcane financial instruments might be. They have no way of knowing that the typical payday loan of $325 ends up getting paid back at about $795. And so precisely because we would never accuse soldiers in these populations of being undisciplined, we have to ask ourselves, well, is there something peculiar about these loans? Is there something peculiar about the permission that credit industries have to use strategies that are designed exactly to disable people's critical scrutiny? And that's what lax regulations arguably did in these cases. And it wasn't until a population with the kind of sentimental and moral force of soldiers were implicated in this process that it got media attention. And the original legislator who proposed the bill in 2002, by 2007, said that he was ashamed that he had ever been associated with it. And since the most recent, the TARP bill, the rates have now a much lower ceiling. So it you could describe it in retrospect as a policy that only left people with bad options. Now, did they have choices? Sure, they had choices. If people needed more money, they could have stolen it. They could have denied their children more or denied themselves more. They could have engaged in other illegal activities like prostitution. Those are choices. But nobody supposes that just because you made a rational decision between bad options that you made a voluntary decision. Mm. These decisions were forced.
Mm. And this gets us back to the choices that we have, and how can we have more choices at the table, and how can those choices be the best we can make them?
Right. You know, and one way you can do that, I mean, if these are social choices, like, or individual choices for that matter, about what kind of healthcare to pursue, if you're of an appropriate screening age for breast cancer, or you're in an appropriate population for HIV screening, there's psychological work that would allow the government to do a much better job at advertising and public health campaigns, much better to precisely those populations. At the moment, the government already does public health campaigns for people in those populations, but the research that's actually done on media message framing shows that certain kinds of messages are just much more effective, and we need the government to listen to that research. So it's much better if you want to get people in for breast cancer screening to use negative framing in messages and say, if you test positive, you have a 30% chance of being dead within 7 years. If your test would be positive, and that gets people to go in to get screening. But if you frame it positively, that you have a 70% chance of living beyond 7 years, people don't. But in preventive cases, like if you want people to use sunscreen, positive frames work better. That allows you to do two things. It allows you at once to both get the right people in for screening, and it allows you to advertise much more efficiently so that you don't waste money.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello. I'm wondering if the guest has very much hope that given recent Republican pronouncements getting apparently a favorable response from the public, that if we keep following Obama's policies, we're going to become, as several have said just recently, more like Europe, more like a social democracy, and less like America. Is there? Do you harbor much hope for the possibility that we will move in that direction? And I'll hang up and listen.
Sure. It's hard to say because it's, I think, a complex question. In the first place, it's not always clear that Americans know what's involved in being more like a European nation. So, for example, in some respects, European nations are more choice-driven than the United States. In Sweden, for example, you're given an allotment from the government as a voucher to pick your school. Right? So for the purposes of education, people have school choice in exactly the way that the more conservative proposals of school vouchers would have had it in this country. And so, it would be good if the American public had a more specific image of what it was that they were objecting to. Now, it may be clear enough that one thing they're objecting to is the idea of higher taxation. But while you find in Europe people with higher tax rates, you also find them grousing about their tax rates in the way that Americans do as well. And that's something that everyone has to be honest about, and that, you know, any advocate of making some system more like Europe should be honest about as well. People complain about taxation there, but they're also very quick to recognize what it's for. That they don't have to worry about a broken hip in retirement because not only do they have a pension, but they have health care. Mm-hmm.
Are there other cultures more empathic than we are, and what could we learn from them?
Well, yeah, you know, when we look for empathy, oftentimes we look for the cues of sentimentality. But I think one thing to look for is this kind of long-term planning feature, or these remote planning features, not just long-term in time, but remoteness in distance from an afflicted group,
mm-hmm.
right? So in the Denmark Constitution, for instance, there's an amendment that guarantees citizens an above poverty level existence. We don't have that in the United States. I regard that as empathic, in part because it takes into consideration a certain kind of suffering that's noxious to both people in Europe and in the United States. The United States cares deeply about opportunity. And when you're realistic about what makes an opportunity useful, it's pretty clear that having a certain amount of resources is about the only thing that can make an opportunity useful. And so it's, you can only effectuate your capacities or develop your capacities and talents if you have enough resources to do that. It's one thing for a country to give you the opportunity to do something, like become a great singer or a great athlete. You have the opportunity, but you may not receive any encouragement or any attention or anything like that. So the idea of guaranteeing the population, in this particular case, an above poverty level existence, is one way of trying to do that, to care about equality enough to say, you know, we're going to level the playing field in reality, not just in image.
Hmm. One of the things that you say at the end of the book and at the opening of the close is that, you know, so often we think of empathy as being reactive. We see we see something and we want to make a difference. Let's do it. But also, it's worth thinking about that empathy can also be preventive. Maybe that would be a good place to wrap up this afternoon. Would you want to say something about that?
Right. And actually, the example that I just gave is a good example of preventive empathy. But, sure, when you want to develop empathic policies, you want policies that actually are aggressively vigilant. So, or alert to the landscape so that it can anticipate where people may suffer and try to adjust those circumstances so that they won't. There are some examples of that on the current scene where policymakers are turning toward the constant updating of information about whether a policy has actually been successful. So then they can make decisions about whether to extend the policy into the future or address questions about whether the policy should be adjusted or changed. So the general recommendation would be that in order to be preventive and encourage well-being in places where people may not have conceived of it, it would be worth developing a more science-based government, to use President Obama's words, so that you could adopt a more experimental attitude toward policymaking. You could craft policy using the best research in the science of judgment and decision-making, propose certain kinds of policies, and if people worried that in making them a policy or in making them a law, it would be hard to undo them if they were ineffective, you just make sunset provisions and impose those on the policy so that those policies will die in 7, 8, 9, 10 years if they're ineffective. And they'll be extended if they reach their target goals. So I think one of the closing ideas is that we shouldn't be afraid in a 21st century mega democracy to try to handle empathic challenges as the distances open up between us by using the wisdom of science to anticipate exactly where those gaps will open up and how we can bridge them.
There we'll leave it. J.D. Trout, thank you for talking with us this afternoon.
Thanks very much.
J.D. Trout, he is the author of The Empathy Gap, Building Bridges to the Good Life and the Good Society. He's a professor of philosophy and an adjunct professor of the Parmley Sensory Sciences Institute at Loyola University in Chicago. The Empathy Gap is published by Viking. You'll find our guest online at www.jdtrout.com.